Session number 12678, Mr. R. E. Jones, Reel 6.
Jones, Reel 4. You were saying you got to Carasulli at
that. Yes, Carasulli, that was the rail head. You see, there it seemed to run through a loop and round and come back onto the line again, lower down, you know, the country. And Carasulli was where all the troops, ammunition, goods, everything were sent up, you see, the line. And that was a big depot. And from there we were got off the train, and we were paraded and off on the march. Well, we'd got a guide with us, and of course it was all dark, and we were sent off up country. And there were good roads so far, and then we come on to the rough stuff. And I reckon it was about 5 miles we marched from Carasulli to the 8th Battalion KSLI, which was on rest and in bell tents at a place they called Corsica. And it was behind a high hill. And on the top of this hill was a cross. And it was a general's grave from the Balkan War. And they reckon on that grave was a sword. I mean, we never got up there to see, but we were told these things. And then on the side of us were all swamps. And in those swamps were broken down gun carriages from the Balkan War. Because that was where it had been fought partly. And
now, what was your reception when you joined the 8th Battalion? I mean, how did it?
We got there, and they were before the valley, and so we were put to the sergeant that was our guide. Told us we couldn't go into the camp. We must lie down on the ground there and make the best of it till the rebellion was. I remember it was terribly cold. I shivered and shivered and shivered all that night, lying on the ground there, because, you know, it used to be terribly cold at night, yet it was 105, 110, 120 in the daytime.
It should be late August, or would it be in September?
Yes, late August. And, it was. The nights were terrible, cold. And days just the opposite. And I remember I shivered all that night. And then when they didn't have bugles, they had whistles then, you see. Because we were like in reserve there. We'd come back. The battalion had come out of the line, come on rest. You see, they come back for a fortnight. Well, then they were in bell tents behind this big hill.
So after you were lying waiting, what happened then?
Well, when the activity started in the camp, you see. Well, then the sergeant got us all together and marched us in. And we thought that we were going to have some breakfast. And we were told, no, there's nothing for you today. You're not in rations. You see, you know, the quartermaster ordered, you know, what many got, he orders so many for rations, you see, the next day. But of course, we hadn't got there. And of course, we weren't in Russia that day. And we had to eat our iron rations. Now, you know what iron rations are.
Do you want to tell me, though? Yes.
Well, the iron rations are in a linen bag with a reeving string. You pulled up the strings and tied them. And inside are two or three big biscuits, army biscuits, a tin of bully beef, and a tin with a soldered lid. The lid was soldered down. And inside that tin was powdered milk, tea, and sugar. And whenever you had a kit inspection, always the officer looked to see if that seal had been broken. So, of course, you'd be intact. Well, that was our iron rations in case, you know, of no rations. So we had to have our iron rations. That's all we had that day. And, of course, we were put in rations the next day. Well, then the next day came and we were...
That first day, did they put you into a company?
No, we were issued in bell tents, you know, and we were put in bell tents. Then the next day, we were paraded. Then we were given companies. And I was in 16th Platoon D Company. You see, that is A Platoon 1, 2, 3, 4 Company, you see, and that. Well, I was in 16th D Company, 16th Platoon.
Who was your platoon officer or sergeant?
The commanding officer was Colonel Erskine, Lieutenant Colonel Erskine.
What was he like? What were your first impressions?
I never saw much of him. I don't think I saw him about twice or three times. All the time in the battalion.
Did he have
and then, of course, we had... I saw the adjutant more, Major Jackson. He was about more. And then there was... There was a Captain Prophet, and...
Was he your company commander?
Captain Day was my company commander.
Captain Day?
Captain Day. And our company sergeant major was Company Sergeant Major Wall, W-A-L-L. He was a really decent fellow. He was one of the old army, you know. He was in a pre-war army, but he was one of the decentest chaps as ever I served under. He was very, very fair, and the quartermaster, I can't remember actually the quartermaster's name, but they always had their own tent together. And, of course, when we were in the line, they had their own dugouts together, you see.
What about your platoon commander? Who was that?
That was Lieutenant... Oh, I can't think of his name now. We had two or three. Because, you see, while I was there, they came round and were canvassing for... officers to go to the Air Force. You see, that was the time when the Air Force was starting, and they were getting officers to volunteer, you see, for air duties.
So you changed officers?
That's right, yes, to go for training. And of course, I think a couple of our officers went. And
so that was some of the people you joined D Company. What were your first impressions of your platoon and your section? I mean, the men you were going to fight with. What did you think when you first met them?
What the other men think?
The other soldiers.
Well, much the same as if you went into a different camp. You didn't know anybody, but you got to know them. You know, they'd come and ask you questions about. chaps would have been up there before you, you know. They'd want to know what it was like, you see. Where'd you come from, and what was it like in England now, and what was happening, and so you made friends very easily, and chaps would communicate with you straight away. You know, they wanted to know what was happening, and where you come from, and if you come from Shropshire, oh, and, well, of course they were all KSLI, but the majority of them were Welsh miners that were there when I joined them, and they'd all come to Shrewsbury to enlist, you see, and but they were a grand lot, really. You know, the comradeship in the Great War was marvellous. Oh, chaps relied on each other too, you know, so much that they were real comrades. And they'd do anything for you. And so then I was posted to a D Company, 16th Platoon. And when we come on, we were put on parade, you see, and all that. And the adjutant had come and called out for the special bayonet fighters. See, so of course I went out with the group that we'd trained together, and the others were marched on one side, and the battalion, you see, were put round, and we were to do the latest bayonet fighting, you see, to teach them how to do the latest bayonet fighting. And we had to do that every so many days. And so I was in a special bayonet fighting squad. And there's one thing I was always glad of. I never had to use my bayonet. I should have... I couldn't have done that. I dreaded that. Although I was such a good bayonet fighter, I dreaded using that bayonet. It didn't seem as I could do. You know, it's all right with when you've got a sack in front of you and all that, but a human being is a very different thing altogether. As I read of one in France that you had to use his bayonet, and he said, the feeling of that bayonet going into a person and you could feel the bones, and that, he said, it was terrible. Oh, he said it was nauseating. It was terrible.
And that's how you felt as well.
And I felt I couldn't do it. I couldn't have done it. I should have had to have done, perhaps, because I should have been killed myself. That's where you're up against it, you see. You've got to kill or be killed. So, it's, I mean, you do things really you wouldn't dare do in ordinary life. And that's the difference of being in battle. It's a case of self-preservation. So you do, goodness knows what things that you wouldn't do ordinary. You see, and no, it's and they've asked me. Well, I've been asked. No, oh. How in the world can you chaps jump out of a trench and go and run forward when you've been fired at all the time and all that? And he says, good Lord, you wouldn't get out of the trench while there was bullets all going about. I said, well, that you don't understand. We were trained. We were, well, you might say, indoctrinated. When that whistle blew, when the officer blew that whistle, you lost everything. You went.
We'll obviously come on to that.
That's discipline.
Now, so what else were you doing while you were in that first period?
Well, then
we
were so far in there, and I think they were only there for the week.
What were the tents like? They were in tents, you said.
Yes, there were about 10 of us in a bell tent, all to win the pool. Now, this is the thing that you've got to watch against. Of course, we weren't up to it, but you soon get to know. And you've got to watch your boots. Because somebody, instead of getting up and going to the latrine, would use your boots. You see? And when you're going to, you'd have to empty them out in the morning. Oh, I always slept with mine under my pillow after that.
It happened to you then, did it? Yes.
Oh dear, you learn these things by experience. And experience is a great learner too. My God, now you watch it in future. And it was really nice weather and very hot and that. But these other chaps were in drill khaki and we were in serge. We were sweat to death.
Were you doing any actual duties during that week?
Not really, no. No, we were more or less being taken into the what would you call it? Into the being of the comp of the battalion, integrating, and then of course it come that well, back up, you see, and tents struck and everything like that, and they all packed into the limbers. Well, I don't know, you know what a limber is? It's a truck with two pieces. And drawn by a couple of mules, and those were our kit bags, and that were stacked in the limbers. You see, and then that was our own transport. Used to do that. Well, then we did the marching. You see, of course we got our packs on our back and everything like that, and with the packs and all your equipment and everything like that, and your 240 rounds of ammunition. And that, and they all weighed about 90 pounds, you see, and we were in surge at the time. So we went through it, you know. But nobody thought anything about us in the uniform way. We didn't give anything. And we were marched off with the rest, you see. We belonged to the company, and you formed in your platoon. Well, you just marched off with the rest and to go up the line, you see, and then we went up and in places, you see, you'd go up a deep ravine, and then you'd have to branch off perhaps another ravine, and then you'd go through barbed wire. See, well, the barbed wire in these ravines was sometimes about 6 foot high, you see, and it was always made like that, you see.
What do you mean? Sorry.
There was two, where they joined like that, so that you went in here, you see.
There was a gap between.
That's right, that was the gap, you right. See. Not a plain gap, you'd got to know where these gaps were, you see. Well, your guide would take you through. And then we'd start single file, you know, getting up. And then we'd, it'd be getting dark, and we'd have rest. And when it was practically dark, you see, and then we'd file into the along the communication trench into the trench. And on the and we were leaving the 12th Cheshires, and so they were standing two, you see, at dusk and dawn. You always stand two on your fire step, you see, on the fire bay is like a ridge in the thing, and you step up so you can see over the top, and that's your fire bay and your fire step. so that you can fire your rifle over the top of the trench. And of course they were standing too, which is always done at dusk and dawn, and we filed behind them, you see, along the trench. Then of course when we were allotted, you know, one behind each man, see, and that, then as the order come, stand down, you see, they'd stand down and we'd take their place. Then they'd file out. That was a relief, you see, relief in a lot in the line. And then of course
did you always do it like that?
Oh yes, more often than not it was like that, yes.
Now what did the trenches look like that you were taking over, and what could you see from them?
You couldn't see anything when you were in the trench, walking along the trench. You couldn't see anything at all.
Was it dug down, or was it...
Oh yes, dug down.
How deep would it be?
Oh, I should think 6 foot.
And what about the... it was just dug in, down into the ground. It wasn't
down into
barricades.
Down into the ground.
6 foot.
And there'd be some places that would have wire netting along the top, you know, to keep the top up. And that the Royal Engineers did that.
And would there be...
Mostly.
You mentioned the fire step. That would be in the firing bays. There'd be a fire step.
Oh, now then, I would say. There'd be perhaps four of you. You see, perhaps from that wall to the end of that curtain.
About 8 foot.
You see?
Yes, 8 foot.
And then it'd come, the trench would come this way, and be along there, and into the next fire bay, you see? And this was all a zigzag, you know.
And you'd have the fire step in the bays.
And in the fire bays, yes, but and not in the trench itself.
And what about a parapet and a parados? Would you have them? A parapet and parados.
Well, the parapet was, of course, the front, like on top of the fire bay, where you looked over the parapet from the fire bay. But there was nothing special about it.
Well, were you using dug boards at the bottom of the trench, or was it just bare earth?
No, we never had much dug boards at all. I never saw a lot of dug boards.
Were the sides, was it just earth, or was it rock? Rocky?
Oh, earth.
It wasn't
in
rock.
The majority of cases. And sometimes you'd come across rock, but and then of course there was small dugouts built in the back of the trench, you see.
What were they like?
Well, there's only about four of you could get in.
So about how big would it be, roughly?
Oh, you couldn't stand up in them. Not in those we had in the trench, you couldn't stand up.
So under 5 foot?
It was more or less for, like at night when there was only sentries on, you see, and they were sleeping. You see, and you'd get...
So it's really just a hole?
Pardon?
Just a hole?
More or less, it wasn't...
Would you have any kit or gear in there?
Pardon?
Would you have any kit or gear in there? Would you leave your kit there?
Yes, but we left our kit.
You'd left your main bag.
Now, in the difference in Salonika or Macedonia and France was this: we seldom stopped in the trench in the day. There was only sentries, one in each fire bay, you see. We filed out and came into a ravine, you see,
behind.
That's right, just behind the trench, so that we were, if called, you know, we were there, you see. But we came out of the trench, and then we got some decent dugouts in the ravine.
What were they like, those?
Well, those weren't too bad. You could stand up in them, and of course we had a blanket over the doorway and candles inside, you see. And that, unless of course you were assigned to do other duties.
Now, why did you file out of the trenches? Why didn't you stay in them in the day?
I don't know. But of course, I think it was heat was one thing, being in the heat. Another thing was that too much movement gave the show away. And we were on foothills, you see, with the mountains up there, see. And like it was a case of you couldn't do much movement because you'd be seen. And then, of course, there'd be a salvo of shells over, you see. And so there was as little movement as possible during daylight. And then, of course, the food was brought up.
Hang on. So you'd start, the day had start was stand two.
That's right, yes.
And that was just standing on the parapet.
Yes, you'd be standing there until it come more or less daylight.
And then you'd file out.
Then you'd step down. Then, of course, you'd be, there'd be one, two, three, four, you see, sentries. One sentry, and the second sentry would be there with him. He'd sit down on the fire step. And then the others, two, could go, you see. But they'd got to come back, you see, to relieve these two. You see. And so that during the night, when we had stand down, the sentry was up there. But you were sitting on the fire step, you see. And so all he'd got to do if he saw a movement was to kick the next chap to him, you see. Well, we knew what was happening, eh? See, and there'd be a kick along the four of us and up we'd have to get.
But in the day, two of you would go back.
Yes, so yes.
And then you'd just come back up.
Like that's right, yes. And so that was what rest we got, you know.
When you were on sentry, would you actually look over the top then?
Oh, yes.
Didn't you have to watch? What about snipers?
Well, of course, it was night. You didn't look over the night in the daylight.
So what did the sentry
you
do?
You weren't on the fire step in the daylight. There was a periscope. You got a periscope or something like that.
So what?
And more or less, it was the lance corporals or the corporal and the sergeant, you see, were all about, you see. They were there all the time going from one to another, you know, so that anything would be distributed quick if you got a stand to or anything like that, if there
so
was an attack.
Day, the
but of course, I mean, the majority attacks don't come in the midday.
So the sentries in the day didn't look over the top, they were just there.
That's right, yes, yes. And perhaps you'd have a periscope, or the sergeants would have a periscope and all that, and you were...
But you were listening more than looking.
That's right, yes. And
if you weren't then on sentry duty, what would you do during the day then? You'd go back to the ravine, and what would you do during the day?
Well, nothing much. You might write a letter. You might do something like that. Or a bit of reading, some did, and that. But there wasn't much peace. As you might say, there wasn't much peace still. You'd say you couldn't settle down to do a lot. Because there was always, here so-and-so. I mean, you know, a little fatigue as you were sent to
what
do.
What sort of thing?
Cleaning something up or something like that. Cleaning some pans up in the cookhouse and helping in the cookhouse or something like that. There was just according. And there's one thing about it now, and I didn't think about this before. The sergeants and that didn't seem to have any favourites. No, the NCOs, the sergeant major or anything. You'd think they'd, you know, they'd have favourites where they'd give them, you know, let them off for you. But that didn't happen. It was more, there was such a comradeship that it wasn't necessary. And it's a funny thing, and I haven't thought about that so much as I have now. There was no favouritism. No, I never knew of being anybody, being a favourite of anybody.
So it wasn't like when, the married men had got the extra leave. That had all gone?
No, that had finished, yes. We were so dependent on each other that we were all pals. We were comrades, properly, pure and simple. One depended on the other. And we were all pals together.
Now, you mentioned, how would the rations come up? Did you ever go on a ration party?
Sometimes you'd go down if they'd bring it to the end of the trench, you see. And because there were different communication trenches coming in, you see. And you go to the end and help to carry the things, and then the ordinary man would distribute them, you see, as you carried it along. Whatever the meal was or anything of that, the ordinary man did the dishing out. And except at night when we had hot soup at 12 o'clock, that was in the winter. And
12 o'clock in the day?
12 o'clock at night, midnight. We had hot soup in the winter.
What kind of soup?
Pea soup, always pea soup. And it was always cold. And it was that hot, they'd got so much pepper.